Y'all, oh my
Hey,
God.
Dylan and Connor here together.
We're together in New York and we had to hop on the mic. I don't know if this has ever happened before.
Only one time. It was after we saw the final dress rehearsal of Wicked before it reopened on Broadway. We immediately went home, pulled out the microphone, and recorded, but guerrilla style
I know, but
podcasting,
this is
y'all.
years later and we
feel so high on life, so happy. We
feel.
just saw Cabaret on Broadway,
At the Kit Kat Club, Mama.
period, which obviously opened last spring. And when it was announced that Eva Noblezada, who is a dear friend of the pod,
Period.
and Orville Peck, who is a hopeful future friend of the pod,
Well, yes.
were going in as Sally Bowles and the MC. We knew we had to go and see it. Connor, I'm so glad we did. You know what? When I visit New York, because I don't live here, it's so rare that I want to see something twice, but this was so worth it.
I know. I seriously, the way this production eventizes the leads coming in every few months or whatever is so smart. And you look to me at intermission and you go, "So there's this perfect Broadway revival."
Listen, it is amazing. It is so great. It is so tight. I mean, obviously, Mimi Scardula, everybody in the ensemble is fantastic. But also, like, the supporting players really help elevate this already brilliant
I
material.
know what you're gonna say.
Ellen,
I knew it.
Harvey,
Say that.
you know, Bebe Neuwirth originated that role in the revival a year ago. But Ellen Harvey, who has not, I wouldn't say quietly been doing good work, but she's always been doing great work, is playing Fraulein Schneider. And she is, I mean, she broke my heart.
Absolutely devastating performance, but she just brought such layers to it and so
The
funny.
chemistry with Stephen
Oh my
Skybell
God.
was
They were
fantastic.
so funny. The pineapple scene with the paper bag. Oh my
I know.
God.
I believe the two of them are remaining with the production, which it sadly announced it's closing in mid-October, I believe, with a gaggy final. You know, you mentioned eventizing Billy Porter and Marisha Wallace,
Yeah.
who you saw in Guys and
I
Dolls
did. She's
in the West
unbelievable.
End.
But wait, I need to go back for a second and just say, and I'm not just being like horny tweeting on main Connor here for Orville Peck. Y'all, Orville Peck giving a Broadway debut for the ages. I mean, not only does he look incredible, the mask is off. So you see his
The
full
mask is
face.
off, and I was honestly
Oh,
shook.
wait, it is so impactful in a way, the layer of we as a crowd going to see this celeb quote unquote casting, but we've never actually seen his face and the way makeup and costumes play into the MC. And then,
No
no
spoilers.
spoilers, but oh my God, I just got the chills. The way it all just plays out over the course of the production is just out of this world,
I
out of
know.
this world.
He really was genius with it. He was fierce when he needed to be fierce. He was quiet and scary in other parts. And just the presence that he had throughout, like whether he was lingering, because this is an immersive production. You know, it is an immersive production. And so him
Right.
being sort of lingering in the background,
The
his
whole
presence
story.
just loomed large over the entire story. And obviously we know Eva has slayed any role she's ever taken on. This might be her best.
The way she was able to make the quiet moments feel so big for this character, I really was gagged. Dylan, I stood when she did Cabaret
You
at the end of
did
the show. I
instant standing ovation.
shot to my feet. I
Oh,
literally had like full body shakes. I know it may sound dramatic, y'all, like as we're talking about this,
on a
but
podcast called Drama.
I seriously was so moved. And again, the production remains relevant.
It's
The
funny.
story.
Yes, it's funny. Like in spring of 2024, it felt insanely relevant. We're like, oh my God, this show that was written forever ago. It's even more relevant
I
now.
know.
It's why theater, you know, is a mirror and why people need to be going to see this show, because you will be so sad you missed it if you don't make the trek to the August Wilson, which has been transformed in a way that I mean, we've never seen the likes of on Broadway before. But Orville Peck and Eva Noblezada are with the production until the end of July. And then you have the chance to see, like I mentioned, Billy Porter and Marisha Wallace, all geniuses. The rest of the players are perfect as well.
Yes, go see friend of the pod, Henry Gottfried as Ernst.
Yes.
Oh my God. And I'll leave you with this. Dedicate your book to me. I had to. Too. I got chills.
My God.
We were like quoting up to like, because we've seen Cabaret before, but as we're, getting ready for the night, we kept saying to each other, Cliff's final monologue.
Oh, my
And
God.
then to hear it in person, we were both, I think, shaking.
Shaking,
Like,
shaking.
we didn't like break the moment by nudging each other or anything, but
Right.
I was like, I know Dylan is having like full body chills. FBCs are
Yes.
in play here.
Oh
They
my.
are in play.
There is a perfect Broadway revival in New York right now. It's Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club. Miss it and regret it forever.
And to quote loosely, Lisa Rinna. I think he deserves a Tony. Orville Peck. What will he do next on Broadway?
Something original.
Because that voice is stunning.
I will say, I hope it's with Eva, because the two of them had amazing chemistry as well. And they're in the way that only Sally and an MC who interact yet don't in Ooh. Ways.
Oh God, keep me chills.
Can. Yeah.
Y'all have got to go see Cabaret. All right. One last thing before we get into today's amazing episode with Graham Phillips. I want to tell you about our Patreon, patreon.com/thedramapodcast. If you go to that, you join the Drama Plus family. Drama Plus is our bonus content platform where we have extra episodes where Dylan and I talk.
It's basically this. It's basically this. Yeah, it's very off the cuff. It's not interview style. It's just conversational. And we have so much fun. We have, there's over 100 episodes there too, to join in the over 300 episodes of drama. So if you're on a long car ride, just need something to fill your days, we have so much fun on there. And you'll also be added to our Instagram close friends,
where we post about Orville Peck.
Right. Among other things.
Although we've taken it to Maine, baby.
You have.
Oh, anyway, time for the show.
Press play. Curtain of an hour in. It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama.
Oh, that's a tweet. Did they book?
Who got nom?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today?
Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more.
Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
I am Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell.
Dylan, how are you? You're here.
I'm good. It's the first day of summer.
Today is... I think it's tomorrow.
I think it fluctuates between the 20th and the 21st, but someone listening can correct me on that. Okay. But it's the summer solstice. We got Pride coming up.
Yes.
There's so many fun things to see, friends to hang out with. And I always love when I'm here because then we can record together.
It's the best. Nothing like it. The next step will be we return to in-person interviews.
Do you think so?
I need it.
Wow.
It's so fun. But Dylan, okay, so we saw Pirates, the Penzance musical last night.
Right.
And Jinx Monsoon, for one second, she's like the queen of Broadway right now. The theater world in general.
We have
Pirates. She did Chicago.
Yep.
And now we know this week she will be playing Mary Todd Lincoln in Oh Mary. I mean, what incredible casting.
I genuinely feel like we threw her name out there last fall when Oh Mary was just on Broadway. And we were talking, I think it's when we were talking to Taylor Trench, we were throwing out potential replacements. We were like, Taylor, you would be great.
Taylor would be great.
And Jinx feels like a no-brainer of a choice. Oh, and this is exciting. I hope that they can continue to creatively recast because she's going to be fantastic.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, Titus is going to be, Titus already did it, but will be another amazing Mary. Mm-hmm. And wait, I would love if Katya did Louise, Mary's friend.
Oh, hilarious.
Yeah. Can you imagine her doing the ice cream on her pussy scene?
It would be so funny.
It would be so funny.
Yeah, it would be great. Or I think Jennifer Samard would be fantastic as Mary.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. Just putting it out there. Speaking of Jinx, though, she also did another New York project a couple years ago that our guest is now starring in. So this is all very connected.
Wow. Yeah.
She did Little Shop. I don't know if it was last summer or two summers ago.
I think it was like two springs ago.
Okay.
Or one spring ago.
And that's another show that continues to give the people what they want, bring in fun, creative casting choices.
Yeah, that's such a good point. They really do. They keep going. And I'm so excited that our guest is in it, first of all.
I know.
We've been waiting for his New York stage return.
I know. I mean, I listen to him on the 13 cast album all the time. So it only feels right now that he's back in New York singing on stage. Why don't you read him in?
All right, here we go. Y'all, our guest today is an actor, singer, writer, and director currently making his long-awaited return to the New York stage in Little Shop of Horrors as Seymour Krelborn. You're sure to know our guest from his incredible resume of television, film, and stage roles, including Zach Florick on The Good Wife, Ben Tennyson in the film Ben 10, Race Against Time, and Evan Goldman in the Broadway musical 13. Other film credits include Staten Island Summer, Blockers, XOXO, Evan Almighty, Goats, Yes Day, and so much more. On television, he memorably appeared as Nick St. Clair in Riverdale, as well as in Atypical, Secrets and Lies, and in ABC's The Little Mermaid Live. On stage, he starred in two critically acclaimed productions of Sunday in the Park with George, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, opposite Calista Flockhart and Zachary Quinto, and performed with both the New York City Opera and Metropolitan Opera. With his brother Parker, our guest co-founded the film studio Phillips Pictures, which led to his feature film directorial debut in 2019 with The Bygone, followed by Rumble Through the Dark. He's a voiceover artist, Princeton University graduate, and truly a Renaissance man. Please, welcome to Drama,
Graham Phillips.
Well, I'm so happy to be here, guys. That is definitely the most efficient synthesis of my career I've ever heard. Wow.
We'll send it to you and your team. Feel free to use it for whatever purposes you need going forward.
Please do. If you could give me a one under 100 words, that'd be great for my next playbill. Thank you.
Oh, Graham, we're so happy to have you on here. We've already been having some fun with you and your doggy and a nice, beautiful summer Friday in New York.
Yeah, it's gorgeous out. It's been hellishly hot and humid, which in the West Side Theater, there's kind of two zones. It's either, Hades Town or it's Ice Age 4. And so you really never know what you're going to get. So it's just so nice to be able to walk around. It's perfect out.
So nice. Well, we always like to check in with our guests right at the top of an episode. And we like to ask, are you well?
Am I well? Yeah, I am well. I think today, honestly, is the first day that I can genuinely say I am well since kind of like halfway through rehearsals. I just wasn't that familiar with Little Shop, which is crazy to say, but it was just a lot to ingest. I mean, suddenly Seymour. But even that, like I was messing up little words just because I'd only done it, like drunken karaoke like 5 years ago.
Of course.
And
Right.
so it was a lot to take in. And yesterday was my third show. And, I just realized that even if something doesn't come out completely right, I know the role so well that I can improvise the moment and I'm pretty nimble at it now. And my nervous system, go, you did good, kid. You're doing all right.
Wait, so yeah, how was that first performance then, your opening night?
So my put-in was Tuesday at like 1 o'clock. So that was the
Okay.
first time that I'd done it with the cast and with costumes and the band, lighting and all that stuff. So at first I thought it was kind of diabolical that like the very first time that I'm really getting a sense of what the show is the same day as my audience is going to be there. But the other alternative, since everyone's dark on Mondays and with all the matinees, they didn't have the bandwidth to rehearse on Saturdays and Sundays. It would have been on Friday and then I would have had 3 days off and then all of Tuesday off until the show. And I was like, that doesn't sound very good either. But it went great. It was probably the least nervous I'd been for an opening. And that actually made me nervous. I was like, why don't I have my normal nerves? Like, this is really, it's kind of bizarre. But I think that some of it was just, we'd just given it our all for a performance like 4 hours before. And it went great. I had so much fun. The cast is amazing. And I mean, just so cool to be up there with Liz. It's been a minute,
Crazy. I know. So you and Liz Gillies met doing 13, right?
Yeah, we met doing the workshop for 13 out in Connecticut.
Oh my God. And how old were you at that time?
We were both 15, and then we turned 16 during the run of it on Broadway.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That's so crazy. I'm a huge fan of that musical, Graham. I love it so much.
Oh, good.
Such a huge fan. We had Jason Robert Brown on our podcast last fall, and I think Jason was tickled pink by all of Dylan's 13 questions and
Yeah.
love and everything
Well, I
that he
talked to him
shared.
about the song Being a Geek that I love so much. And I didn't, because I'd never seen it, I'd only heard the album. I didn't realize the song isn't actually in the show.
Yeah, I only got to sing it one night
Yeah,
before it
that's
became a
crazy.
one-act show. It was a two-act show ending with a song called Here I Come. And then as a one last-ditch effort to try to keep the two-act structure and not have to collapse it, which I think meant that one of Liz's songs also needed to be cut, which nobody wanted. They switched the finale from Here I Come to Being a Geek, which had been in the Mark Taper Forum version.
Okay.
And so I went over to Jason's house and he played it on piano and just taught it to me and we put it in that night. So it was it was an active previews process for sure. And so I got one performance of it and that's all that lasted. And then we showed up to rehearsal the next day. And
It's a beast of a song.
I love that song so much though. I feel like it's such a I wish it lived in the show. I mean, it lives on the album, but it's just too
Yeah.
good. Like so much of the show is set, it's high octane. And to have that introspective moment that just starts to happen when you're going through puberty, like out of nowhere, you really
Oh,
start to
yeah.
realize like, wow, like this is what isolation really feels like. And I just love it. And it's such a bop. It just has a groove to it.
It really does. Now, I know when we recorded with Jason last fall, we were scared shitless. I mean, he's just like obviously a titan of musical theater. Were you intimidated by him back then or still?
I wasn't then. I think I'm more intimidated now. Just because back then, I didn't really. I think that my superpower was holding like precociousness in one hand and total ignorance in the other. Like I was well learned, but I also like didn't have that much experience on stage in New York, and I just didn't really know the ins and outs, and so I didn't really know protocol and whatnot, and I was very focused on the present and just getting the job done. Yeah, JRB is a super exacting dude. He knows what he wants, and his music is incredible. It's really hard to emulate his sound. He said it. I mean, he's a titan, and I love. If you guys have ever seen him at Birdland, I mean, you can really get a sense for what he's packing there. Yeah, he's just. I mean, he's also he's a sweet guy, and I can't wait to work with him again, honestly. I mean, it's just I love his music so much. I wish I could do bridges right now. I just gotta grow.
You could be the sun.
Yeah,
Oh,
that's
true.
true. That's true. I don't want to be the sun. I did the sun in the workshop.
I know you don't get to
No.
sing Wondering. You don't get to sing Wondering or it all
Yeah.
fades away.
I know, but I'll just always sing it like Pascal. That's the problem. I'll just do you and I just can't help
Yes,
it.
exactly. Oh my God. Wait, okay, so going back to you and Liz, so since 13, have you two kept in good touch over the years?
Yeah, we have kept in good touch. You know, we kind of have a web of friends that have stayed pretty close. I mean, Ari and Aaron Simon Gross were like childhood best friends from Boca Raton. So like really bizarre that they ended up in 13 together. Like it really is that is super weird. Like they are best friends and then somehow ended up being in 13 together. So they're obviously still really close. Liz is one of Ari's best friends. I've known Ari for a long time. And Eamon Foley, who directed me in Sunday in the Park with George, is friends with all of them. And, you know, we've all kind of split off and done really interesting, different things and transitioned from, you know, one area of the arts to another. And there's moments of distance, then we'll kind of come back and check in. And there's a lot of care there. And it's been nice to sort of have that touchstone because it was such a formative experience. I mean, it was crazy. You were all kind of, you know, just that age, you're kind of in going through your first relationships and trying to figure out like what it even means to be in a relationship, what it means to be a friend. And
Hey now.
and so, you know, it's just such a formative period that for it to also be tied with like the craziness of doing a Broadway show, it's just hard to kind of explain what that's like. And so to have people that were there and were like, yeah, I remember that. That was crazy. Really nice.
That's really special.
Oh my God. You know, I just forgot. I totally forgot. Liz and I did an episode of White Collar together randomly.
Oh my
Oh my God. No, I did
God. Love that show. I loved that show so much.
Yeah, there was like, and my character was kind of, oh my God, it's Little Shop. He was kind of nerdy and was clearly pining for this like attractive, sultry, you know, 40-year-old like jazz crooner type person, you know, in a 18-year-old's body. So, you know, Liz. And I forget what happened in the end, but it was like Matt Bomer's character was like trying to set us up in some way. I guess it was like the plant. Yeah, it's so funny. I totally forgot about that. That was so bizarre. It's just so weird when you end up working with your friends because especially when you don't have any say in it and the universe kind of pops you together.
And is that what happened here with Little Shop?
Yeah. I mean, they wanted Liz to come back because people were loving her and I think she wanted to take a little break for her voice, but she didn't quite want to say goodbye to it yet. And so I think she was waffling a little bit. She wanted to, but she was like, I don't necessarily want to do it with someone I don't know. And she's like, who would I do it with? And Eamon and I were at her and her husband's house. And Eamon like looked at her and she was on the phone with like, you know, someone who like one of the producers or something or her reps. And he was like, hello, like Graham. And I wasn't there. I left the room and she was like, huh. And I heard this all secondhand because I walked into the room and they were just looking at me and I was like, what? I had no idea what he sort of talked about. And Liz was like, yeah, what about Graham Phillips? And they were like, yeah, approved. I think Michael Mayer was either on the line or they like had texted him or something. He's like, yeah, I love Graham, loved The Good Wife. I'm like, cool. And a part of it, I think, was just like they're like, yeah, let's just find a way to keep Liz. And if we can keep Liz and like Graham will be fine. But yeah, she totally stuck her neck out for me, and I'm so grateful. It's the first lead in a show I haven't had to audition for, so that was really
Wow.
cool. I've never
Yeah.
really had that happen before. It's always been, the whole singing for your supper thing. And yeah, so I think that also made me work in some ways even harder because I wanted to, if you get recommended by one of your closest friends, you don't want to make them seem like a fool. So
Yeah.
putting the time, the work, and it's such a great show to, it's so receptive to making bold choices. Like you can't really make a wrong choice as long as you go for something. So that's been really fun. Like as long as you don't try to hide, as long as you just let it explode out of you, then it works.
Yeah. How much of yourself do you relate to Seymour? I mean, I feel like you strike me as a more confident person.
Well, you're catching me in a confident day. I'm almost done with my first week. I haven't had any major catastrophes. Even though my Oura Ring says I got a 67 on my sleep score, I can test that. I think
Okay.
that it's far higher than that. I had a great audition with Zach Quinto. We did like a chemistry read Zoom right before this, and I thought it went really well. So writing on that kind of high. But the truth is, I'm actually I do deal with a lot of anxiety. Like I gotta meditate twice a day just to like really stay present. I can get really stuck in, how I wish things would be rather than seeing how they are. I think there's a 13 lyric about that.
It all comes back here.
It all comes back. I mean, there's this one moment in Little Shop where he says, but then there's Audrey, lovely Audrey. If life were tawdry and impoverished as before, she might not like me. She might not want me. Without my plant, she might not love me anymore. And I definitely think that, there's a part of my personality that's got that child performer, golden boy thing that associates any care or, affection that I get or worth that I get from other people with doing a good job. And, the last couple of years, I've really been trying to tease that apart. But it's cool getting to go through this show because it's all about the sort of horcruxing of the soul in order to get that power, that validation. It's funny, it's kind of like the opposite, the exact inverse of Hamlet, whereas he has it all and he's going to inherit all this power and status, and he rejects everything external to try to save his internal world and his internal integrity and his soul. And like that's, and the cost is everything in the external world and his life itself. It's sort of the opposite in Little Shop. He comes from a place with no status and no real like external worth, and he little by little corrupts his sense of integrity little by little until he seals his fate. So it's just funny to me that
Yeah.
I was working on Hamlet in an acting class and I was doing this. I was like, wow, this is literally the opposite journey. But yeah, I mean, I really do relate to Seymour, and it's taken a long time for me to relax out of this association with my worth and my identity, that being separate from what I do. And it's tricky because sometimes there is a correlation, sometimes the work that we put into a certain area, it grows our garden and it manifests in success in some way. And so sometimes it is an indication of like, really putting in the work without regard for the external results or validation. But then it's just, it just so happens that that's a result. It just gets tricky when that's like the motivator, and that's kind of where that's the fuel for living. I had this rude awakening. I screen tested for Tony in Spielberg's remake of West Side Story.
Oh my
Oh,
gosh,
wow.
you'd have been fantastic.
Thank you. And it was kind of like a rocky way. Like it took a long time to hear that it didn't go my way. I was supposed to have a one-on-one meeting with Steven, and I was in Europe and I'm going to fly back. There's all these weird things that happened where it like looked like it was going my way. I'd heard from someone who's in his family through my singing teacher that like things were positive. So there was a lot of indicators, and the whole thing had been in a way kind of like it felt like divinely ordained in a way, because we did the workshop beforehand underneath Lincoln Center, underneath the Coke, the place where New York City Opera was. And my first lead role was The Little Prince. And weirdly, I met Eamon Foley for the first time at the audition process for The Little Prince. There's like this photo, for whatever reason, the New York Times, like the art section, they followed like the quest to like find the Little Prince and like cast the Rose, because it was just unusual to cast two young leads for an opera. And there's a photo of
Yeah.
Eamon and I sitting like next to each other in this rehearsal room underneath the theater. And anyways, when I walked into the first day of the workshop, which all I'd done before that was a self-tape, there was the poster for The Little Prince, like right next to the door. And I walked in and it was the same piano and the same exact place where I'd done The Little Prince like 13 years prior. And so there was just this sense of like, wow, like this feels right. And then there was also the added layer of this homecoming to, I hadn't done musical theater or really been singing very much in a long time. Because after 13, I did The Good Wife for like 7 years and I went to college and
Yeah.
I kind of became a little disillusioned with acting. I was like thinking too much and trying to just do the right thing and not make mistakes rather than like inviting a sense of play and imagination and learning more about myself. And so just the process of reconnecting with music just opened my heart. And so all of that opening happening with this sense of, oh my gosh, like all these synchronicities are happening, like maybe it's meant to be. When it didn't end up going my way, it was like such a rude awakening for me. And I realized I kind of, put me in a funk for like over a year. And I was like, why is this, yes, it's a big role and it was a tough no for sure, especially when I thought it was going my way. But like, what is this really about? And I realized so much of what I had gathered in the process, I'd like hitched that wagon to the result. All this work that I was doing, I was like, oh, it's for this role. It's for this other thing that can easily be taken away from me in retrospect. And so it really forced me to, that whole like golden boy idea, like, oh, finally, like me, I'm special. I'm gonna be the one, in lights, and like it's gonna be this big movie that everyone's gonna see, and that'll show them, and I'll have worth, and I can, in a weird way, I'm so grateful it didn't happen, because I would have learned a lot about, myself and the arts in some ways. It would have kept me from learning about myself in a way that I wouldn't trade for anything, and I now have a better understanding of just how interesting and unique this tightrope walk is in the arts, where yes, it's for the audience, and also it has to also be for myself. It has to be for the part of me that can't really be taken away. And so it required me like talking to that young part of myself and getting to know like that really young part of me, and to start rewiring that relationship. And anyways, a bit of a rant, but it
No,
really
that's okay.
is weird to think that a process of rejection on that level could really affect me so much emotionally and spiritually. And it's changed my relationship with art and with other people, and yeah, just with myself.
You seem like you're doing well. I mean, all things considered, as we said at the beginning, your nervous system is finally calming down through this process. But on this topic, it sounds like, I'm such a firm believer in everything happening for a reason. And I feel like it definitely did. I mean, I would have loved to have seen you in that film,
Yeah.
but
Yeah, my
so
mom would have too.
selfish. But I'm so glad that you were able to really like reflect on it and take in these lessons and really reevaluate your relationship to everything. I feel like it's probably also challenging when you've been working for most of your life in the same industry. Like, sure, you said you went to school and stuff, but working for other people all the time in that way is probably very interesting, especially when people are watching your work constantly,
Yeah. Something I've struggled with is when a director in particular has a sort of more authoritative, like parent-like tone. There's like, it was big in like the 70s and 80s, I think, transactional analysis. And it's a lot about like the parent-child dynamic. And it's about how pretty infrequent that we relate to each other as two adults. And that, when someone comes into a situation that has like a sort of parentified tone, like you really shouldn't do that, it oftentimes triggers like the child response in the other person, where even if they don't reply and say like, oh, sorry, I'm sorry, even if they sort of rebel against it and they're like, don't tell me what to do, like you've kind of already lost because you're stuck in this, this childlike dynamic. And so it requires a real like spaciousness to get out of that. And particularly, as a young actor working with, the power dynamic of a director to actor relationship, and having been an actor since I was so young, when someone comes up to me with that energy, I've just started in the last few years realizing like, wow, that's super unuseful for me as an actor, because the second I'm trying to do, just sort of like what we were talking about before, the second I'm trying to do this performance to please any individual out there other than myself or the story, or the art of it itself or the truth of the moment, it gets really pear-shaped like pretty fast. And so I've started to learn to just let them know, like, hey, give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm sure you're not meaning for this to happen, but I just want you to know that I'm feeling like I'm in like a parent-child dynamic right now, and it just doesn't feel good to me or conducive to me doing my best work for the show. And it's just been incredibly effective to stopping it, because what's there to really say other than like, oh, I didn't know that that's what was going on. Okay. Because ultimately, you're the person that's gonna, if you don't do a good job, it's gonna reflect poorly on the director. And a lot of times they're just insecure about getting the result that they want, and they're just not aware of it. So that's been really interesting.
You're speaking to my soul, Graham.
We were just having a
Literally.
conversation about that's very astute of you, Graham.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I just knew it. I knew it had to change. I was getting so overwhelmed. I was like, I need to read about this. When I looked at it, I was like, oh, this makes total sense. What's going on here? There's this really young part of myself that is being talked to. And so, of course, it's responding. But unfortunately, only with the emotional intelligence of like that 6-year-old or that 9-year-old or, whatever.
Speaking of, you as a child, we do like to go back with all of our guests to the moment when they realized they did love the arts. And we borrow Ring of Keys from the musical Fun Home because we like to think of it as this moment of recognition where you were maybe participating in something or taking something in and you realized, oh my God, I identify with that and I need to be a part of that. Do you feel like you had a Ring of Keys moment at some point?
It's funny you guys were saying you just saw Pirates. Seeing Pirates of Penzance, I think it was like one of the PBS specials with my brother, who's really into swords, and he's 5 years older, and we work together now. But I just loved watching that with him, and that's definitely a core memory. I had like really bad ADHD as a kid. I still kind of do, I guess, but I know how to work with myself in a way that doesn't make me run away as fast from the task at hand, or I'm doing the dance a bit. My mom also noticed that when I was doing shows or when I was singing, yeah, my nervous system just like relaxed into just channeling whatever was happening. And so to have a track and be like, oh, I know what I'm actually supposed to do, and I know what's going on. So to have the freedom within those constraints, I'm like, wow, this feels really good. My first role ever was an Annie. It was Star to Be.
Oh, a pivotal role.
Oh yeah. I couldn't really speak very well at that time. It was like, three buck, two bags. I couldn't like say my words very well. But yeah, I caught the bug. And the first like lead that I had outside of just school plays was this. It was Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day at Laguna Beach Playhouse. I'm from Laguna Beach. And they were going to cast someone who was like 13, 14 to play this 9-year-old. And I was 9. I might have even been younger than that. And so Joe Lauderdale, who was the artistic director and really nice man, he called my mom. It was like, look, we'd like to go with your son, but we just look, rehearsals are like 10, they go to like 10:30. Is he going to be able to stay up? And I was like, yeah, he's like, he doesn't go to sleep until like late anyways. Like, sure. So I did the thing. And on the last performance, I just bawled my eyes out. I like was so overwhelmed with the fact that it was ending. And man, I'm getting emotional just thinking about it. And it was like this, I don't think I understood that theater has always happened and like will always continue to happen, which is like the beautiful thing in the wake of AI and all that is like there's always been and always will be a place to see, to collect in a group and watch people sing and or dance or talk about what it is to be human. And I didn't really understand that I was just so young that I didn't know that there would be more opportunities for that. So I talked to my mom and my dad. I was like, how can I do more of this? They're like, well, maybe there'll be another show at Laguna Beach Playhouse. And then like 6 months later, they watched it and I was Googling agents for kids. Like I'd like figured out you need an agent. I didn't know what that really meant, but I was like, I know you need one. And my mom walked in and was like, you're not allowed to use a computer. Like, what are you doing? Like, oh my God. So my dad's a lawyer, and he talked to an entertainment lawyer at the firm he worked for, and they kind of made the connections. And so I got a manager who was also kind of like an acting coach, which is, I guess, what you need when you're that young, because you just no idea what's going on. And then it just kind of went from there. I mean, another pivotal moment maybe was just that the Broadway Kids album, which Eamon was actually on. You know, everything in my life comes back to Eamon Foley.
It
All
sounds
does.
like it. Oh my God, I love that. Wait, okay, your dad's a lawyer, and then you did 7 seasons of The Good Wife. What did he think of the lawyering happening on television?
I think he wishes that there is as much drama in his law firm as there was in Florence. No, he loved it.
And things
He
moved as quickly, I'm sure, because in real life,
Yeah.
it's months, you know, years.
Yeah. He was a federal judge, actually, or he was an
Ooh.
attorney, and he definitely appreciated all the characters that were playing the judges. I mean, one of the cool things about the show filming in New York is we got so many amazing, like Tony-winning character actors to play all the judges.
Oh, yeah. The Good Wife happened after 13, then, or was it simultaneous?
Yeah, it happened 6 months after we closed.
Wow. I loved The Good Wife, Graham. It was so good. You were in it so much. I mean, you and the daughter, I forget her name suddenly, but
Grace, Mackenzie Vegas.
Grace, how could I forget? She was very religious, wasn't she? Didn't the character go through like a religious storyline? Wait, what
Oh
was
my God.
I've only seen The Good Fight, so now I need to go back and watch now that I know that you were
Isn't
on
that
all the
crazy? He
seasons.
jumped right to Good Fight.
Good
I'm so bummed. I was almost gonna be in the Good Fight. The Kings called me and they were like, we're talking about it. And I was like so excited. I was gonna be like I was gonna be like kind of like a political operative of some sort. And like, yeah, and I was so jazzed. And then
Damn, that would have been
it
amazing. You and Audra
never happened.
and Christine Baranski. Wait, so looking back at like those 7 years on The Good Wife, was there a storyline that your character went through or something that stands out to you as a very memorable moment or an arc, maybe?
I feel like all the relationships Zach had were so weird. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I was awkward and I didn't know how to like behave around any, women, but always felt just so bizarre. I remember this one scene where my girlfriend was like trying to get me to like get a diamond stud in my earlobe. She's like, you'd look cute with that little like a little diamond stud right there. And I like looked at her and like she looked at me and just actor to actor, she's like, that is so not the move. I was like, I know it's so not the move. Like, what are we doing here? I'm just remembering the most absurd parts of the story. There was like some like recording box or something in the foyer of our apartment where it was like my dad like left the house and he was really not supposed to because he had an ankle bracelet on, and he was.
Oh my
He
God.
was being monitored and he was out on bail. And I like used my skateboard to like destroy it, but like make it look like an accident.
I remember this.
I just thought it was so funny. Like, the kind of like, I'm like a tech guy, but like, I'm also like a skateboarder. And I was like, what am I? Like, what are you doing? I was like, I can suddenly do like super specific tricks that can also like break a specific piece of technology. I'm like, well, this is wild.
I did love when they'd have Zach like in the mix. Like he'd be like helping with the case on
Oh
the
yeah.
computer and stuff. That was fun.
Oh yeah, just clicking away and
I feel like I only picture your character in the apartment. I don't remember many scenes of you outside of it. I don't
Yeah,
know.
no, I'm at the computer always. I'm either like pretty much either I'm like hacking into the mainframe to like affect like the future of Chicago and American politics or like looking at like smut. Like that was it.
Oh, is there a storyline? Oh, yeah. Well, of course, you know, teenagers, you know, but.
Oh, I think that actually when it showed that there was something kind of weird up and I like closed it really fast, there was an episode where that happened. And I think what it turned out to be like was actually some like evidence or something. Like she thought Zach was looking at porn, but actually he was like doing a deep dive into like these photos that had been taken of his dad and he was like getting them removed or something like that.
Wow, you got a good memory. For as many episodes as you did, you really can remember all this stuff. Wait, I want to talk to you about another one of your television projects. Connor and I watched Riverdale until the bitter end.
Oh, right.
And when you popped up, we were gagged. I mean, it was so exciting. And you did a fantastic job. Was that fun to do?
Thank you. It was fun. It was fun. I mean,
Talk about insane dialogue on a TV show, though.
totally. I mean, it was my take was like it's a melodrama of sorts. It's sort of like, here I am, I'm the villain. And I wish that I could go back now and just have more fun with it.
Okay.
one of my acting teachers, I think it was Larry Moss, he said, like, great acting is the art of concealment, which I love. It's like, as humans, we so rarely are just trying to express like what we actually, what we're feeling. So often we're managing and mitigating the undercurrents, where we're trying to hide, our true motives or our shadows or whatever. That's why you can have such amazing actors like Meryl Streep, because oftentimes it looks like she's doing so little, but you can just tell there's like this volcanic inner world going on inside. And I feel more comfortable in some ways doing that, where like, all right, I really believe in this truth, and like, I'm not going to show you that. This was just the absolute opposite. In some ways, I mean, so is Little Shop, I guess, where it's like, it's the job to actually show, to be incredibly transparent and give the audience the clarity of motive and what I'm after, rather than like, but I need to disguise it. It's like, no, I'm evil, and I'm a lech and a lush. So that was, I just wish I could go back and just have more fun with it, because there is something really wonderful about, not being worried if I'm doing it right. And I think I was still a little bit stuck in the right or wrong of it all. I want to do like a clown class. Like, I had someone recommend that to me, and I was like, that sounds really fun. Like, really getting into the, I've been working a little bit with, like, not intense like humiliation, but like little things where normally I'd be like, well, I shouldn't do that, or, and then I just do it anyways, like warming up on the city bike, especially like on my way to the show when I'm singing in, falsetto, and I'm just doing, ridiculous sounds, and, like, there's a part of me that's like, don't make those ridiculous fucking sounds. Like, the person right next to you is going to think that you're crazy. And I'm like, yeah. And so what? like, I gotta warm up for my show, and I like warming up on the city bike. And so that when I want to be small and like, oh, I shouldn't be doing that, I just like do it anyways. And it feels like I'm putting a coin in the piggy bank of like, you're doing fine, kid. Yeah, I think that clowning is kind of like the next level of that.
I feel like you can maybe like tap into a little bit with that with Little Shop. Oh, for
Yeah,
sure.
that's a great, thank you. I appreciate that. I think I'm gonna bring that into my show tonight.
Okay. What was it like doing Virginia Woolf with Calista and Zachary? Like, that's such a great show. Oh my God.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience. I can't believe we only had like 3 weeks of rehearsal to put that up. I was just so impressed with Calista and Zach. I thought it was, I mean, it was so unusual, because in some ways they're playing like the opposite person's personality. Calista has this sort of transparency to her, and, has a very like sort of introverted playfulness, and is just very like mercurial, I guess, that sort of airy like water energy, at least just from like interacting with her. And Zach, I'm getting fire and I'm getting earth. Like, he's very intense. He has like a, a very, and I told him, I was like, I'm actually like a little frightened of you. And he's like, what? He had like a noodle in his, he's like, huh? And we like, we're going on a walk, and he's like, why? I was like, I don't know. Like, it's, your energy is so intense. And like, I can tell like how passionately you feel the way that things like could be, like that idealism of like, it could be this, it could be great. Anyways, just that sort of like intense fire is like not something that I would normally associate with George, and or that's more of like a Martha quality. And then George, sort of mercuriality of like, I can disappear, and sort of the passive aggressiveness, not that Calista was passive aggressive, but just that, that sort of ability to move and to navigate in a way that can work around an environment in a really unique way. I was like, well, that feels more like George. So it was just really bizarre to see them have to play, sort of just put on the other person's hat. But it works in a way, because at the end, then it all comes down, and you see like the little girl who Martha is underneath, and you see the repressed rage that George has had, built up over their entire marriage and life. I thought it was really effective, but yeah, it was just really fascinating to watch that all go down. As far as my experience, I just had a blast getting to play on that stage. It was one of my favorite genres, is like the living room play, where you have just this exquisite, like, drawing room or whatever. And what was great is at the end, so we had this bar cart, and, we were drinking like whatever, iced tea instead of bourbon. But at the end, Harrison Ford came to the show, and for closing, and Calista's husband, and we all like got to sit on stage with the ghost light, with the little like sconces on and everything. and just like actually pour ourselves drinks for the first time in like the 2 month run and just sit around and actually just hang out. So I have this great photo of us all like just on stage. It looks like we're just in a living room. And
Yeah.
yeah, it was great.
With Han Solo.
With Han Solo.
Graham, this is your New York return. Were there ever any brushes over the last like decade or so where maybe there would have been a chance you were going to come back to the New York stage in any capacity?
Yeah, it seems like I got to like the final few on like so many of these things. Water for Elephants. Oh, I got really close on the Back to the Future
Oh.
Broadway
Oh.
run, which my dad was really bummed about because he just loves that movie.
Oh yeah, classic. Well, I'm glad you're back now.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to be back. It's also kind of nice to, you know, it's one thing to do something for a full year. Like I love that. And also I've never done that before. Like 13 only ran a few months.
Right.
You know, we're gonna go ahead and blame the the recession of 08 on that one.
Of course, of course. It was a bloodbath on Broadway that
was
January.
Hairspray closed in
Yeah.
the same week as us. Hairspray.
Yeah. All the shows. Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, I haven't done like a long run, so I don't know. I'm happy with my little 6 week little shop kind of thing. But
Yeah, so you're in it through July. Is that
yeah.
the run? Okay. You know, as brothers who work together in this podcasting enterprise, I always love talking to people who work with their siblings in like a professional capacity. What is it like working with your
I
brother?
mean, it's the greatest joy of it to me is just getting to know my brother better than I ever would have otherwise. Sometimes it comes with difficulties in that, like, we never argued at, like, ever before we started working together because we had nothing to argue about. Not really. I mean, my brother's like a total peacekeeper and like great on boundaries, and he's just like an awesome guy. And then once there's two of us and there's only one possible like door to go through, you know, and it's something as personal as creative resolve, you know, just stuff comes up, especially when you're doing something artistic and there isn't always a right or wrong answer. It's just like, you know, like if you ask David Lynch, like, why do you do that? He's like, I don't know. I did it because I felt like it. You know, I want to go
Yeah.
for the beautiful fish at the bottom of the sea. And, you know,
I love this David Lynch impression.
I know I'm getting back into TM.
Yeah. You did another impression on here that I was gagged for right when we started talking. What was it? Oh yeah.
Oh,
Yeah. Oh
Pascal.
yeah. Oh, my short-term memory here is crazy.
It's funny. Yeah, I've been singing some of Little Shop with Liz as Pascal. It's been great. Trying to remember what we were doing. It was like,
Does she do like a Kelly
oh
O'Hara?
yeah, she does it all. We've been
Yeah.
we're gonna do a recording of Suddenly Seymour just full country. Like we realized it's a country song. We're like, Suddenly Seymour, standing beside you. And she comes in with like this whole like, no, she just started just speaking. It was so brilliant. We were just at her place like a couple weeks ago. It was like a late night karaoke thing. And she just starts saying, nobody ever treated me kindly. Mama left early. Daddy was poor. And just like, you know, before she started singing, it was so good. It was very like, I don't even, it was like George Strait meets like Johnny Cash and, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, I love
So I
it.
think we're going to record that.
So we need it now at this
Yeah,
point. Now that you've teased.
we're
Yeah.
going to get the band to play it once we arrange it. So that would be great.
So
Yeah.
fun. Wait, so what are you and your brother working on right now?
We have a bunch of stuff in the pipeline. It's just about figuring out where the pieces are going to land. There's this psychological horror thriller film that I love and he loves. It's called Blackwood. It's based on this novel written by Michael Ferris Smith and takes place in the 70s. It's about this welder who comes back to his childhood hometown after having left for 20 years to confront these sort of core childhood traumas that happened that he's repressed. And the whole town, since he's been gone, has been taken over by this vine that exists in the South, called kudzu. It's actually up in New York. I mean, it's all over the place, but in the South, it just blankets like anything that's left idle. It looks crazy. Covers up the trees. They look like ghouls and ghosts. And if you leave your house for, it can grow up to a foot a day, sometimes like 2 feet a day. And
Oh my God.
so it'll just like take over cars, or there's like these beautiful images that are really haunting of school buses and houses that are just completely enveloped in these vines, like coming in through the windows. It's like something out of Jumanji. It was brought over
Yeah.
from Asia in like the mid 19th century for soil erosion, and it just like took off. So it's like this metaphor in the film of the things that we, you know, that we don't look at, that we leave idle, like what happens to them when they're shrouded in darkness, and it ain't pretty.
That sounds amazing.
It sounds
It
so
sounds like you said it was
good.
a novel first.
Yeah, it's a great novel. It's just such a Michael's such a brilliant poetic writer. It's that whole Southern Gothic, noir world, like Cormac McCarthy, and that
Yeah.
it's just it's the best. That whole like No Country for Old Men vibe. And yeah, so we're taking a lot of cues from Eggers, that kind of like slow burn, like there's something off here. It's got a little bit of The Shining in it.
Ooh.
And yeah, so we're excited about that. And then we have, we have other things. We got like a couple comedies we're working on the other side of the spectrum. We're trying to figure out which one to put all our chips on next. It's a hard time for indie film right now. We just want to be really specific about, which one and in which order we're doing it.
Yeah. Well, it all sounds amazing. I'm excited for all of it, to be honest with you.
Thank you.
Before we say goodbye, we do like to end with a dose of drama, which is just a little taste of sort of maybe what you've got on your mind, what you're into right now, what you're thinking about, rant, rave, anything like that. I will go first.
Okay.
There's only been one thing on my mind these last couple of weeks, and it is Love Island. Did you watch, Graham?
Oh,
I don't.
Oh my God. It's lowest common denominator, I would say, with like brain power. But I think that's what I like about it. You just kind of unplug and watch it. My only complaint is there's too many episodes. It is such a commitment,
Oh my
but
God, it's so
it
hard to
is
keep
so
up
fun.
with.
And I love that so many of our friends are watching it too. So we can like, keep in touch in that way. It's true. It is fun to have a show that like everyone's watching or like, groups watching together. So you can like really, Yeah.
I almost enjoy talking about it more than I do watching
You've
it.
said that.
It's more
Yeah.
fun.
But that's what's on my mind right now, Love Island.
Yeah. Graham, do you watch much TV?
I do, but I'm more like I'll watch like Last Week Tonight, or I'll like if I really need to turn the brain off, I'll watch like Rick and Morty. But yeah, I've been watching like more films recently. And honestly, like I've been just trying to read like during the show. Like I'm just
Wow,
I know.
commendable.
Isn't that crazy? Is
I love
my rant
it.
about reading? Let's bring it back, baby.
Yeah. Yeah, what's your dose of drama, Graham?
Dose of drama. Well, one complaint that I have is, I just got this place in Chelsea, and people just don't pick up their dog's shit in Chelsea. I don't know what it is. I mean, I know a lot of people do, but there's a lot of people that apparently don't. And I live right across from the London Terrace Towers, and
Beautiful.
they just need to, I think we need to get a collective going to just figure that shit out because it's driving me crazy.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you're going to step in it eventually. Like, that's the thing. It's like people are just inconsiderate.
No. I never will. I'm like, when it comes to avoiding things, I'm like a ballerina, and
The floor
that's
is lava vibes.
not just referring to dog shit.
Yeah.
I guess another thing that's kind of been like me having a bit of a renaissance for me is like, do you guys know about the Enneagram?
Yeah, but I've never done it. So I don't know what my number is.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So I've this guy Russ Hudson, he wrote one of like he's written a few of like the biggest books on it. He kind of decries like the state of where the Enneagram has gotten, which is like, you can easily compare it to like it's kind of like Myers-Briggs, but
Yeah.
maybe a little more focus on like core motivations and like core wounds and like, where it's all coming from, like the why rather than like the what. I think it's on my mind because he saw the show yesterday, and I'd gone to like all these workshops at Esalen that he taught, and he's like, it's not just like a go bag like of personalities. Like it's not just like, oh, that's cool. Like that explains why I'm exactly the way I am. Like next, he's like, there is like a whole spiritual process around it. And like, when you really get into it, it's more about like bringing online and into alignment your body, your heart, and your mind. So your body can be relaxed and present, your heart can be open, and your mind can be, curious and creating clarity, no matter what your personality type is. I've just been having a ball thinking about because it's so motivation based, it's so useful for acting.
Oh.
Because I can just look at a character and go, all right, this person's super objective. Like what is it that in their soul that they're looking for? What's that thing that they will never have enough of? Like their entire life, that's their engine. How many people go through their lives and then are like, yeah, I got it. I'm good. People generally have to go through a lot to get to a place where they're like, not defeated, somewhere between like defeated and complacent, like where they're actually satisfied and they're like, ah, I see, I can give up this ridiculous rigmarole that my ego has been trying to, set me up to get this thing that like is the carrot you never can catch. And so it's been really fun to like to work on.
What is Seymour's Enneagram type?
Oh.
I was thinking about that, I think he's either a five or a six. So five is the investigator, and they always want more information. They're like the specialists.
Okay.
They're both in like the head triad, which just means like the problems and like the stickiness and some of the values of the ego structure. Like it kind of has to do with that center of intelligence. It doesn't mean they're smarter necessarily. It's just like that's kind of where a lot of the energy lives.
Okay.
Yeah, the five is that investigator energy. Like a lot of people who like collect a lot of things or like learn everything about a very specific area and go really deep, like Seymour does with, botany. That works out. When they get stressed out, they actually, because in the Enneagram, there's all these connecting lines. It's like a shape, basically. And when a five gets stressed out, they tend to take on the qualities of what a seven can be more like when they're unhealthy. So, and I identify with the type seven. It's like the enthusiast. It's the sort of like the Epicurean, like variety is the spice of life, like always moving to the next thing, like always trying to have a joyful experience and like really running away from negative emotions and, not wanting to be trapped in something. And so sometimes there's an avoidance of commitment and things can get very scattered. And that kind of happens, like you see that happen a little bit with Seymour, like when he's like, oh, this is good, cool, we can do this, we can do this. And then he starts layering on so much that it becomes unmanageable. He also could be a six. A six is called the loyalist. They're very loyal to their structures. They like to work within a system, whether it's like medicine or law, or a lot of people going to government who are like that, but not all of them. Liz says that she's probably a six. And they're always scanning. If seven is scanning for like the next joyful experience and how to like hedge future dopamine, the sixes are scanning for like what's the possible catastrophe that could happen and how to make sure that it doesn't happen. So they're super prepared. Their anxiety is almost like their superpower. Like they can oftentimes, and I have a lot of that six vibe and in me too. It's like the one thing that the sort of procrastinating energy of the seven, like I'll get to it later. There's more fun things to do. That six vibe, like that's my wing, is what they say. That comes in and it's sort of like the like, but if you don't do this thing, you're going to probably fail majorly in front of a huge audience. I'm like, okay, good point, good point. I'll actually spend another 30 minutes of memorizing. And I think that nervousness and that like retentiveness of heart. When like a six is really buried in themselves, and there's all different levels of people who wear their personality more lightly or more gracefully. But when you're really stuck in it as a six, it's like it's this debilitating, it's very much that like Dear Evan Hansen level, like I can't interact and interface with the world very effectively, or I have to like construct something that people can interact with because I'm so fearful about, what could happen in every interaction. And I feel like Seymour's got a lot of that going on.
Yeah, he
Oh my
does.
God, you're making me want to find out what my Enneagram is. I'll have to make that my
Is it
home.
just a Google, like, is it available for free? Like, if you just Google it? I mean, honestly, if you're interested, you can do like an online test. I think the best thing to do is to like buy like a good book on it and like you just kind of skim through it and then be like, okay, maybe it's that. And then like read the short chapter on that and then like really look at whatever you really get to decide. And
That's
oftentimes the one
cool.
that you maybe you don't necessarily, you're really like kind of triggered by, you're like, well, that's not obviously, that's not what's going on. Like sometimes it's like, okay, well maybe come back to it later. But yeah, Russ Hudson's book, Understanding the Enneagram, is like a really good starting point, I think. The Wisdom of the Enneagram is like the giant like Bible one that's really interesting if you want to do that next level. But yeah, the first one that I looked at was Understanding the Enneagram, and it was great. It's also like fun. You start to understand like family members that you were like, what the fuck is wrong with this person? And then you go, oh, that's what they've been up to. Like, okay. So it's made me a lot more compassionate.
That's so fascinating. Oh
I
my
know. I
God.
should. I've been curious about it for a while. So I feel like
This is the
I'm glad
moment.
we're chatting about it. For sure. Oh my God. Okay, really quick dose of drama from me. I have been obsessed with this podcast documentary series about SoulCycle. It's called The Cult of Body and Soul. I used to work at SoulCycle from 2018 through 2020, and I still ride there and stuff. So I cannot recommend it enough, y'all. The Cult of Body and Soul is basically about this group fitness experience. class called Soul Cycle and its origins to now and why people, basically at its core, why people became so obsessed with it and why we may never have something that, like that again. So
yeah, it's amazing.
So good.
What's the like the spark notes, the core of that?
Ooh, very interesting. They were basically creating a fitness experience that was more than just a class. It was a therapeutic, inspirational, community-based ride. Like the instructors aren't even certified in anything but Soul Cycle. You don't even have to be like a personal trainer or have any sort of like qualifications like that. Like they really just wanted people who could take you on a journey from start to finish while riding a bike that goes nowhere, but it takes you everywhere. And you know, they yeah. build this whole vibe, and
then there's merch, and then there's, you know, you become obsessed with the instructors and then you kind of follow them and like this idol worship. Have you ever done Soul Cycle, Graham?
Oh yeah. There's also a part of me that feels like I've been talking to my buddies about this quite a bit. Like this is like a micro rant part two. Just we become so distant from our like tribal origins. Like if you look at the whole pie chart of human experience, like we were tribal peoples in communities for like 99.9% of our existence, and it's only in the last like 200 years or so that a majority of the planet has deviated from that. Now we're all in separate homes and much more individualized. You know, we used to gather in groups and like dance, like not just to like, you know, to get fucked up and like, or to celebrate, but like to like express things and to let it out and to like collectively, you know, alchemize all these bizarre things that we as humans go through, and to sort of understand like, yes, and that's welcome and that's medicine. And, you know, we gathered in groups of men and in groups of women and like, and all together. And there was like this, you know, all of these different forms of gathering that were so important. And I just feel like we kind of miss out on that. And then also, you know, I'm not going to like get into like the religion of it all, but one function that I think religion has had, you know, for all of its faults,
yeah,
it's been massive, is it gets people like into the same space. And so there's something like, about that that feels very old, whether it's necessary that it's done in that certain way or with certain doctrines, you know, that's not for us to necessarily talk about, but like there's something about that gathering that's just really important. And you know, so much in modern day like spirituality, it's like this, the rejection of that is like a very individualistic and can sometimes be like a lonely experience, which can be I think also really important, and like it's, that's a wonderful thing. But it's like that added support of being in a group and like really losing yourself in that. I can see how that would tie into like the if people are starving for that on some level, like Soul Cycle shows up and it's like, yeah, I don't know why, but this is just like totally hitting some reptile brain business right here.
I think you're so right.
Yes.
I love group fitness stuff. Like even when I'm at the gym and like no one else is around, I'm kind of like feeling less into it for some reason. I don't know why. I like the motivation and feeling like we're all doing something together, I guess. But
yeah,
it's kind of like going to the theater too. Like I remember during COVID, we were all like watching stuff at home, but it just did not hit in the same way.
Totally. Theater hits that same spot.
Whether it be a live performance or or at a movie theater or cinema, you know, like it's just so different. But
yeah, that's true.
Anyway, oh my gosh. I could go on and on about it, but you got to check it out. The Cult of Body and Soul, the Soul Cycle.
I will.
Podcast documentary. Graham, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. It's been so nice to get to meet you. We've been fans for so long and you're such a lovely guy. I'm thrilled that you're back on the New York stage. We've got to come check you out. And everybody else does too through the end of July, right?
Till July 27th, unless I decide to do it longer.
There's that option. I'm sure. I love it.
But yeah, thank you so much, Graham. This really meant a lot to us. Thanks for all the nuggets of wisdom too.
Yeah, thanks. I hope it wasn't too didactic, but I love talking to you guys. This was such a treat.
Oh, thank you. And you're just at Graham Phillips on social media, right? Instagram.
That's it.
Amazing. Everyone should follow Graham there. Follow us at the Drama Podcast, Connor at Connor McDowell, me at Dylan McDowell, and Connor, I will see you next time.
Drama.
So good.